to my point on the perfect pricing model doesn't exist. There's trade-offs in either direction. But, you know, ultimately where we landed was one other thing we did try, which is covered in this post I wrote, the why we changed pricing 3 times in 1 year, was we actually, for the first time, were not transparent about pricing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Product Marketing Life podcast, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career. Back to the Product Marketing Life podcast, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. We haven't met before. My name is Colin Majak. I'm the lead product marketing manager at Classy from GoFundMe. And in this episode, I got a chance to sit down with Matt Hodges. If you don't know Matt, Matt is the head of product marketing at Equals. And we got to have a conversation about Matt's journey in product marketing. We talked about the multiple rides he's taken on the unicorn roller coaster and currently what he's up to at Equals. We also did a little bit of a dive on his experience with pricing and naming and some of the takeaways that Matt has from his time at Equals. I really enjoyed this conversation with Matt, and I think you will too. Enjoy the episode. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Colin. It's nice, bright, and sunny here in Sydney, Australia. I'm pretty warm outside, so good day.
I was going to ask where you were in Australia. I used to work at a company that was founded in Sydney, and a bunch of the Aussies that moved to the US said they just like could not get used to Christmas actually being cold here. The flip. You lived in SF for a bit, right?
Yeah, 10 years. Yeah.
Okay. How was that adjustment for you?
I'd say fairly welcome because I'm a skier and I love skiing. But now that I'm back in Australia, it is really nice to, if it's a nice day out over Christmas break, to go down to the beach. We're only, you know, 10 minutes from a bunch of the different beaches and the northern beaches in Australia. And so it's just a very different day. Like, you're not in the house staying warm, you know, probably surrounded by friends and family having food. You're outside usually after you've done some of the festivities in the morning, and maybe you come back for lunch or dinner. So it's just different, but you know, I could do either. I don't have a strong preference for one over the other.
And how did you cope with all the fog in the bay?
I actually lived in, most of the time I was in San Francisco, I was in the Mission for like half the, at least, you know, 5 of the 10 years. And then we were in Noe Valley for much of the time after that. And the Mission rarely got fog. It actually got the most, I think, sunlight in the city. But yeah. Noe Valley was right on the cusp. And so I remember our last place we were in Noe Valley, you know, we'd had our first child at this point. And so for the first time we had a house. We weren't in a, you know, one bedroom apartment, and we had a nice big outdoor deck with my barbecue on it. But it was rare when you could use it, because, you know, Carl the Fog would roll in at, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's right.
And it was really hit or miss as to whether it was going to be nice to sit outside. I think most of the time I was fine, because I was living in the part of the city that wasn't impacted by it. But when I do go visit my friends, or I go over to the US for work, which I do quite frequently, or visit my wife's family there, a lot of my friends now live in the outer Sunset, which gets,
I love the sunset.
It's beautiful out there, but when it's foggy, it's just like, why? If it didn't have any fog, it would just be, you know, be perfect, because it's not too hot, doesn't get too cold. You have the beach right there. Yeah.
I think it's the amnesia about those foggy days that gets, you know, that comes in when you have this beautiful day in the sunset where you could see straight down the road, straight to the ocean. Like, you just forget that it's foggy 75% of the time when you have those really like incredible days in the sunset.
Well, and then you've got Golden Gate Park right there too. So, you know, it's a good spot to be.
Yeah, it's all gorgeous. I want to talk about Equals in a minute, but you hinted at living in SF for a while. And I'm actually really curious about some of the roles that you held leading up to your time at Equals. I can say this because it's not about me. You have a really impressive resume. I was just doing some LinkedIn sleuthing like one does. And I was like, this guy has been at a lot of really great companies. So could you just break down a little bit of your product marketing journey leading up to overseeing product marketing at Equals?
Yeah, sure. So I usually start this story by saying that I didn't plan to move into tech, like when I actually started working. Just happened very naturally. And I was actually working at a, before the days of Apple actually having retail stores here in Australia, I worked for a little shop that resold Apple computers, mostly to companies in the film industry. And I ended up staying there for 3 years, started as a salesperson casually, then went full-time, and then ended up managing the sales team there. And so I actually started in sales and eventually got offered a role at Atlassian very early on. You know, Atlassian was sub 100 employees at the time. This was back in 2008. This was back before the concept of the cloud even existed. I think Salesforce, yeah, within that next 12 months came out with their whole no software push. And so I joined Atlassian because I knew Mike and Scott indirectly from university. They were both in the same, or had been in the same scholarship program that I was in before they dropped out to start Atlassian eventually. And they ended up sponsoring that, the co-op program it was called. And so I knew of Atlassian through that program. And when my course coordinator had said, look, Mike and Scott are starting to hire salespeople in Sydney, you should chat to them. That's how I kind of got introduced to Atlassian. And I think, you know, about 6 months after that, I ended up joining as a technical sales engineer in Sydney. And, you know, Atlassian is famous for not having sales. And so my role really wasn't sales. I wasn't on a quota or anything like that. Yeah. I would help people who downloaded our products. In this case, I was on Confluence, which is at that time was we coined it as the Enterprise Wiki. And I would help you get it installed and understand how the hell to use this thing that is, it's like a word processor, but in your browser, which was very foreign concept at the time.
Yeah, pre-Google Docs, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so my role was really just to get you set up and be successful in your 30-day trial, which again, all involved you actually installing on a server on your computer. And then, you know, so it's quite an involved process. But that was my role initially. And this is how I got into product marketing. I naturally started to, as part of that role, need to create a lot of what I called evaluator resources to let people self-serve during their trial and show them, you know, explain what Confluence was and then what are the different use cases they could use it for and how did it replace and why was it better than what they were currently using. And yeah, we didn't have a product marketing team. And so I created all that content. You know, I did the webinars, I did the demos, I created a Confluence instance called the evaluated resources. And so when Jay Simons joined as the VP of marketing at that time, this was in 2009, I think, he started building out marketing in San Francisco and he asked me to move to San Francisco. And so that's how I moved to San Francisco. And I was in a role, I was in like this evaluator role for a while where I was just, again, like helping people convert through that evaluation phase. And then a guy called Bill Arcanati, who was the basically the head of product marketing for Confluence, got offered the head of product management job in Sydney. And he said, you should give my job to Matt. And so when he moved to Sydney to join the product management team, I took on Bill's role. And that's how I got into product marketing, even though I'd kind of been doing the role of a product marketer for quite some time already.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
that's super interesting.
Yeah.
Well, just even, yeah, sorry to interrupt you there. Just it almost feels like coming through, you had this very tangible problem of people need to understand the product, understand the value of it, and what's different about it to be motivated to adopt and get past this 30-day trial. And finding yourself looking up and realizing you've created this library of product marketing resources and probably articulating some of that differentiation when maybe no one had done it before.
Yep. Yeah, architecting the demo. I vividly remember I'd do a webinar every week using, I think, WebEx at the time. And I had to architect the demo so that the Confluence rich text editor, which at that point was very buggy. I think most rich text editors and products are still quite buggy. It's a really hard problem to solve. I had to architect the demo so it didn't crash during me trying to show off all the things that you can do in Word that you can now do in your browser that anyone can do because anyone can edit a web page. It just needed to be done. I had that content didn't exist and someone needed to create it. We didn't have a team. And so I kind of just did that.
And then that was your break into PMM. Kind of someone spotted you as like, you were almost like somewhere between customer success and onboarding. doing product marketing and someone spotted you and said like, all right, this guy's doing product marketing, given my job. That was your break in. Where did you go from there?
So from there, Jay had hired Daniel Freeman, who was the VP of product marketing and stayed at Atlassian for a long time, as did Jay. And so Daniel started building out an actual product marketing team. And that team just naturally grew as the company grew. You know, Atlassian was famous for growing and still is for like this, you know. And so I was fortunate, I think, to be at a company that had right product, right time. They were just kind of, they always had that sweet spot for a long time. And, you know, I built a small team of product marketers to initially focus on Confluence. And then as each of our different business units evolved, I was the collaboration business, but we had our whole dev tools business, which Giancarlo Leonetti led. He's now the chief revenue officer at OpenAI. And then, Ken Olson led the Jira business unit. We had a bunch of products in each of these different business units. Confluence for me was the flagship. And then we had some add-ons that we sold. And then we acquired HipChat, you know, before Slack was even a thing. And so I had that family of products. And so I had a team of five product marketers by the time I'd left, which was 6 years after I'd initially joined. So yeah, just naturally needed to build a team as the business grew and needed people to focus on these different things that we were selling and that we're growing from memory, like 30 to 50% year over year. And then, you know, I was, you know, it was 2014. I would have been, I'm doing my math now, 22, I think, at the time. Okay. Is that right? No, I can't do my math. How old was I? 84, 30. I was 32. I started to, you know, think about what was next, where did I want to go? And a company called Intercom had pinged me on LinkedIn, the COO at the time. No idea what Intercom was starting to get a bit frustrated at Atlassian. It was now like going on 1,000 people. And, you know, I was not, you know, high level management, I was mid level management. And so I just kind of was young, didn't know, you know, grass is always greener. And I just kind of got frustrated in that role. And so Intercom kind of came along at the right time. And long story short there, I ended up meeting Owen, the, you know, co-founder and CEO at the time, now CEO again, and Des, who's co-founder, chief strategy officer. And I joined as their first marketer. And then, you know, I stayed at Intercom for 5.5 years. There were 50 people when I joined, just raised a Series B. Hit 1 million in annual recurring revenue. And then over the next 5 years, we went from 1 to 5, 5 to 20, 20 to 50, 50 to 80, 80 to 110, I think. I forget what the exact numbers there were, but again, just incredibly fast growth. But this time it was at a pure SaaS company and VC backed, which is probably one of the biggest differences between my time at Atlassian, was it was cloud only and had the pressure of being funded. And so it was a much higher pressure environment than Atlassian was. And, you know, I say this with a lot of love for Atlassian, but the bar of what was expected in terms of quality and output was a lot higher. And so that role really pushed me. And I, you know, I started as the first marketer. I was director of marketing. That then eventually evolved into me running half of marketing, and Des Trainer ran the other half of marketing. And so I looked after product marketing, brand, a team that we called product education at the time, which is really what I was doing with Confluence back in the day, like helping just people learn how to use the product in the best possible way, which you could argue is customer success, but it was really more of a marketing role. So we had a team of product educators. And why am I blanking on one team? I think that was it. I think I just had those three teams at that point. And then Des looked after content, events, and demand generation. And my last year at Intercom, as you know, I think one thing I always, when I do these types of podcasts about my career in marketing, is I kind of knew early that I didn't want to be a CMO. That job sounds so hard. It's not really a job that I want. And I think, you know, it requires a very special individual who is either good at or is deeply interested in all the different facets of marketing, of which there are many. And those types of roles for me pull me away from doing what I love the most, which is like product marketing. And so I don't think I was ready to be a CMO at the stage that Innocom was at to begin with. And so as it became clear that, you know, we need to hire a CMO, I started to think about, well, what do I want to do next? Kind of in a role where I'm just managing, I'm not doing anything. And I ended up moving onto a role on Dez's, at this point, Dez was back in product. So I moved onto a role in Dez's team where I sat on the exec team and I was focused on commercial product strategy. And so I was kind of the glue between go-to-market and product strategy. And that's where I spent a lot of time working on pricing, which I know we will probably talk about in this conversation too. And then I decided to move back to Australia, which is why I left Intercom. Intercom's not at that point wasn't a remote friendly company, and they still very much have an in-office culture. And this was pre-COVID. And so when I decided to leave Intercom, it was actually Ben, who I now work with at Equals. Ben was one of the first employees at Intercom. He might have even been the first employee. He ran growth there for a long time. We've been in the trenches together, as I had been with Bobby, who was head of finance at Intercom, who's the other co-founder of Equals. Ben introduced me to Joe Thomas from Loom. And he said, hey, you know, they're looking for a product marketer. You know, you could probably give Joe some advice, but I know you're also looking potentially for a new role. You guys should chat. So that's how I met Joe at Loom. And I met him shortly before I finished up at Intercom, and I was going to take some time off. And, you know, long story short there, it was right timing. You know, they were looking for a first marketing leader. And I was looking for a new role that was going to be remote friendly because I was moving to Sydney. Yeah. What better product to work on than Loom, asynchronous video, where they're all about remote, and they were, you know, very remote friendly or remote first company at that point. And so that's how I landed at Loom. And I could speak about the decisions I made to join both Intercom and Loom for other reasons, but it was kind of just right time, right fit. And that was September 2019. And I remember that date because I worked out of the SF office for 3 months before moving to Sydney right at the end of the year. And then I was in Sydney fully remote when COVID hit, which was, you know, actually ended up being a real boon for Loom's business.
100%.
And really, you know, accelerated their already great growth. But it was also a very challenging time for me and my family, moving internationally, having a second child. My wife's American, her family's in the Bay Area, primarily in East Coast, and she couldn't see her family for 2.5 years. So it was a very intense year of hyper growth, then also just a lot of stuff happening outside of work.
Yeah.
And I ended up burning myself out. I know it was burnout, real burnout, because for the first time, like in ever, I had went and speak to a therapist about what was going on. And so I took some time off after that, consulted for a while, I think a good, like, was it a year or 6 months? I forget exactly how long I consulted for, maybe a year. I worked with some great companies during that time. Command E, who got acquired by Dropbox, a Series B company here, Quilla, who are awesome. They're actually doing some really cool stuff in product marketing at the moment. If folks want to check them out, it's Q-W-I-L-R, Quilla.com. But I ended up working with Atlassian again. it was come full circle. And so
I brought you right back.
Exactly. Yeah. They had basically an internal incubator in the company called Point A. That was created to give, I think, you know, a place for what was a very big company at that point, you know, I think 8,000 or 10,000 employees or something like that, to innovate and actually build a new product again, because it's been a while since they built a brand new product. And they also, I think, wanted to provide pathways for employees to have like a startup-like experience within, you know, the confines of a bigger company, or the, I guess, the security of a bigger company. And so I ended up working with Sharif on a product there that was part of that Point A program, where they were trying to figure out positioning, messaging, pricing, packaging. And I'd worked with Sharif for a very long time on Confluence. He was on the Confluence product team when I was there back in the day. And so I ended up joining Atlassian full time again after consulting with them for 6 months. joined them full time, focused on that product, and then ended up in a role where I was just kind of put on special projects. And the last two projects I worked on were writing the keynotes for Mike and Scott's keynote at Atlassian Summit or team. Sorry, used to be called Atlassian Summit back in the day. It's now their team event in Vegas. And I also launched Atlassian's first AI product, which was aptly called Atlassian Intelligence. And that was the last kind of project I worked on before I decided to join Equals. And sorry, so that was a very long answer to your question of how I ended up at Equals. But I'd say I ended up at Equals because I wanted to go small again. Like I just kind of learned that big company wasn't for me. And Atlassian was very big, much bigger than I'd ever worked in at that point. Still a great company, but I needed to go somewhere small where we were able to move a bit faster. And I, to be honest, I just didn't have to work with as many different teams to ship something. This was very slow for me from coming from startups. And, you know, I joined Equals is a company I've joined at the earliest stage I've ever joined at. So, you know, I'd mentioned Loom, Intercom was 50 people, Series B, Loom was 30 people, just about to raise a Series B. Equals had raised an A, and we haven't raised a B yet. Probably that's next year for us is when we'll start thinking about raising a B. But we're sub 20 people when I joined.
And still
are 20 people. We're really small. We're still 20 people. And the main deciding factor in joining Equals for me was actually, you know, I have a lot of love and respect for Ben and Bobby because we work together so closely, and I've just seen what they've both done since I've left Intercom, and they've done their own things and grown, and always stayed in touch, and just started following Equals when they started Equals, and thought it was an interesting product and like a potentially very big market. And I knew that it was going to be good from a design and usability perspective because Ben was involved and Ben was bringing in people that had worked with him at Intercom in the past. And Intercom is, I think, world-class at building beautifully designed, well thought out products. And so Ben has a lot of that DNA in him. And so I knew the product was going to be good. And then it was just a matter of, is it going to work with me being in Australia? You know, is compensation going to work for me? And then primary reason though is I trust Bobby and Ben. Like they know what they're doing, and if they think this is going to be really successful, then I believe them and I'm bought in. And so kind of that's how I ended up back at Equals, and now it's been a little over a year and a half since I joined.
Sweet, thank you for giving that story. There's a pattern that sort of emerges when I look at your story. Like something I've noticed is you have this knack for joining companies right before they get really big. looking at Intercom and Loom, and we'll see what becomes of Equals. I want to talk about some of the common threads of like what you were looking for, but you hinted at this about this kind of massive growth at Intercom followed by burnout. Do you think, is that a necessity? Like when things get, you have these high growth companies, I just based on your experience, do you feel like, I mean, I didn't prep you for this, but do you feel like that massive spike in growth naturally sort of lends itself to burning out product marketers in particular, or?
This is based on a very small sample size for me of, you know, now four companies. And, you know, I've worked with other companies when I was consulting, you know, call it five other very early stage startups. So it's still a relatively small sample size, and maybe my experience is a bit unique because I have happened to be on the, you know, unicorn train a few times. You know, call it purely by luck, call it part luck, part good decision making. Because I had no idea what I was doing when I joined Atlassian. That was pure luck. But you know, I grew with them, and you know, I did the same with Intercom and then Loom until I did it. And so I think what sticks out to me, to simply answer your question, I'd say no. And the reason I say that is I'd mentioned this when I was talking about that transition from Atlassian to Intercom, but there was two things that stood out to me from my time at Intercom in terms of how, like, I look back on my time there, even despite as challenging and stressful it was, how much I grew there. And that was, it was venture-backed. Which Atlassian really wasn't. Atlassian did raise a secondary from Excel at some point, but they didn't necessarily need it. And so even after that, the company was growing so well that there wasn't still like that immense pressure that you get in an early stage venture backed company where, you know, you need to grow fast to justify that investment. And so, yeah, Intercom was a bit more of, we had that pressure, but we were growing really fast. But I'd say more of the pressure came from the individuals that I worked with who themselves had just a very high bar for what was good. And part of this, I think, is just part of the, like, it's part of Irish culture where everything is like, they judge things quite harshly and directly and in some cases bluntly. It's not too different to Australian culture, but they always are pushing to be better and better and better. At least that was the experience I had with, you know, a largely Irish team that I worked with. And that just pushed me like to a new level. Like, and so despite how stressful and challenging that was at times, like I look back and go, I'm a much better product marketer, probably like leader than I was if I hadn't joined Intercom.
Yeah.
And then Loom was venture backed as well. So you did have the pressure of, we've got this investment. They, at that point when I was there, hadn't raised a crazy round. But the biggest challenge for me was I was seeing growth that I'd never seen before with more of a prosumer product than a Teams-based product. And so the top of funnel was just so much bigger, like way bigger than I'd ever seen. Intercom's B2B, Atlassian was B2B. Yeah. And so just a way different business model. And probably for me, part of the burnout was some anxiety around, okay, I've just seen the company go from 1 million to 9 million in ARR in a year. And we made some very good decisions that helped that off the back of COVID. We acted early. We halved our prices first before anyone took any action on pricing around COVID. And we made the product free for education. And at the same time, we figured out what we are in this market. And I think we did those three things really well. It was like, I saw this crazy growth that I'd never seen. And then the expectations were then, all right, well, now we got to do that again and more.
Keep growing.
And I was like, okay, I can't see it. Like I feel like, you know, we'd ridden this wave and we were kind of at the peak and I'm like, I don't know whether I can sign up to those numbers. And so I think a lot of my anxiety at that time came from that, not believing that I could do it. And cause I'd never done it before. And then, you know, you layer on all the other stuff that was happening outside of work. And it was just like, my blood pressure's through the roof. My doctor's having me wear a blood pressure monitor for 24 hours. Like you've got to slow down. And so, I'm trying to go back to your original question. Like there is an element, I think, of when you're VC funded, there is just more pressure to start. And then I think depending on when that funding came in, like, and what type of round was raised, there's going to be more pressure on you. Is it unique to product marketing? I don't think so. I don't think it's a product marketing specific challenge. And then ultimately, I think it just comes down to you. Like, do you have a high bar for yourself? Do you put a lot of pressure on yourself? And, you know, if you are that type of person, then those combination of things is going to lead to burnout.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. You take this like cocktail of high achiever, which, I mean, just even you take your posture at Atlassian to be the kind of person who's in that kind of customer success role and says, oh, I could do this more efficiently and I'm going to build this resource, build that resource. Like that's a personality type for someone who sees like an opportunity and like is driven. Take that mix of that plus venture backing, which I worked in a seed stage company and even that was like, there was some pressure because of that, because someone has invested and they want to see it grow. And then take just the urgency of the leadership culture. Like how urgent do they feel like they are? And I guess with Loom, there's this like unique event and whether or not you treat that unique event as the new standard or as, I mean, in this case, a global pandemic. Like that is like a unique, that's super helpful to see kind of those patterns. Like I'm wired the same way where like I have a very hard time half-assing anything. And so like the anxiety.
The pressure you put on yourself, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think that's a good summary. One thing I should be very clear on, I don't want to paint the picture that, like, you know, getting VC funding is bad. That's absolutely not what I hope that doesn't come through. Like it, you know, it's just then you do have people that want to see a return as they should on the investment they've made. Yeah. And I don't think in any of the cases I've been in, there's been an immense like push from the board to do certain things to grow at a certain rate. It's more of the pressure you put on yourself because you want to achieve it. Now I'm sure there are cases where that has happened, but that wasn't my experience at those companies that I've worked at. It's just, again, more about that pressure you put on yourself.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I did not prep you for that. I'm curious now, like looking at some of your decision-making, you hinted that that last Atlassian was luck, but the ones that followed were this blend of right timing and like you were evaluating how this company, like where they sit and whether they have the opportunity to go big. Like when you're evaluating these companies and even like when you're evaluating Equals, like when you joined Equals, what were you looking for? Or were there any sort of signals that you were looking for to see, okay, this product has potential to take off? What do you, like, are there any patterns there that are consistent?
Yeah, definitely. I'll talk about, you know, the moments of when I was like, all right, I want to join these companies. And then I'll kind of come back and reflect on what I think the patterns are. So with Innocom, you know, the first thing I did when I got this LinkedIn email, which I mostly, you know, I ignore most of them, but this one kind of stood out. I went to the website, checked it out, and kind of had got a feel for what it was. Their product marketing at that point wasn't, you know, it wasn't bad. It wasn't great. So it was kind of a bit hard to figure out what they did, but I learned a lot by reading their blog. Inside Intercom, you know, that Intercom was always big on content. And that came from the top down, and they knew the value in content. So I learned a lot about the company actually by reading Inside Intercom. And I remember vividly going to the blog and then remembering I've read this before and thought it was really good. Maybe like 6 months earlier, just come up in an RSS feed or something. And so it was a bit of a combination of, okay, I can see this product. Now I have a better understanding for what it is. Clearly the team behind it are really smart. They write great content. I know that much. And they're writing about interesting things. And when I understood what the product was, I was like, I want to use that. I would want to use that in my job. I could see the value in it. And that I think is pattern number one. When you see something, you're like, I want to use that. It was the same thing for Loom, which I'll get to in a second. So that was Intercom. And then with Loom, when Ben had introduced me to Joe, the name Loom didn't initially click to me. But then before I met Joe, obviously I went and did some research and, you know, I went to the website and I remembered that I'd used the product because I discovered it on Product Hunt with their last major launch, probably when they announced their Series A is probably when they did that. And I remember downloading it and going, this is the best screen recorder I've ever used. It was fast, which was one of their secret sauce, like at that time. It was fast, it was well-designed, and it just worked. And I remembered that moment. It's like, oh, these are those guys. And then when I spoke to Joe and we went out for dinner and, you know, I just got him to tell me what they needed, but also like, what are you actually building here? It became very clear to me that they weren't a screen recorder. They were much more than that. They just didn't know quite how to describe and articulate what they were. I think their homepage at that point said screen recording simplified. And it's like, to me, as I learned more about the product and then actually got in the role, I was like, wow, this vastly undersells what Loom is. And so if I take a step back and I'll talk about Equals separately and I look at both of those decisions, I would say, one, it was product that I wanted to use or had used and had a very good experience with. But then also the teams behind them, really smart, very passionate product people, both like Joe and Vinay, the other co-founder and the CTO at Loom at the time, and then Des, Owen, Paul Adams, like product people who care a lot about brand and design. And so they built beautiful products that looked great and worked really well. And so those were the two patterns that stood out. And I made this list about, you know, decisions I make when joining companies. And I called it the, you know, playing on the four P's of marketing, the four P's of joining a company. For me, it's people, product, position, and then profit in that order. And so do you want to work with these people? Is the product good based on your assessment? And then what's the position? Like, is it going to be a fit? What do they want you to do? Does that match? And then is there potential for this to be, you know, potentially life-changing for you? And so, you know, when I looked at, and so I think in both of those cases, when I understood what they were actually both wanting to build or what their vision was, I could see that there was a big market for both of those, right? At least I thought there was. I'm still, you know, fairly naive, but thought there was big markets for both. And then with Equals, it was very different. I think I kind of touched on this before, but it was much more about, I know Bobby and Ben. And I'd watched Bobby, you know, was prolific and still is quite prolific on LinkedIn and X. He'd do a lot of demos of just like how fast and well-designed and unique this next generation spreadsheet was. And I could get a sense from just watching those, you know, 2-minute demos that they've built something really special. And then again, I had that inherent trust in and that experience of working with both of them that I know they're super smart. I know they're smarter than they were when we worked together because they've both done different things since then and they've got more experience. And, you know, so I knew that I could comfortably work with them and have trust that I wouldn't have to build from scratch. And then it was a matter of, well, what do you need me to do? Is the role right? And understanding the product more, because I'm not, unlike Loom and, you know, Confluence and Intercom, I wasn't a user of it. I wasn't like a primary user of Equals. I am now, and I've figured out like how I use it for my role as head of marketing, but we still don't sell to heads of marketing today. We sell to heads of finance and operations. And so, it was more of a people decision. And then is the potential there? I think the product's great, but then one of the biggest challenges for me over the last 18 months is being like getting into the head of the buyer and the user, because it's not me. And that's been the harder challenge, and understanding how do I communicate the value to someone that's not me. Well, at least, you know, looks like me from a persona point of view.
Yeah. That's super helpful. Something you've done really well since day one of Equals, this is sort of what kind of drew me to you, was that you've been very much building in public. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, folks can go to your LinkedIn and you had this post where you listed the 10 biggest things you've learned at Equals. And it's a treasure trove of blogs that you've written over the last year. It's also refreshing to see product marketers who can write. So that's nice. If you're up for it, I would love to click in on really two of them, pricing and naming. It looks like from the outside, the last year has been a big year of pricing for Equals. And you built a pricing page, you changed pricing 3 times, just like a lot of pricing work. And something you wrote about is that there's no such thing as a perfect pricing model, which kind of broke my heart because I feel like I'm always on the search for one. And I'm pushing, like we're in the middle of a pricing change right now. Can you tell me a little bit about what's your experience been building Equals pricing model? And some of the trade-offs you feel like you had to make if there's not a perfect way to get there.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say, first thing I'd say is it's not just me working on it. I'd say like Ben's our co-founder, chief product officer. He's really a lot of the strategy behind our pricing, which I'm behind the strategy and very supportive of. I just want to make that clear because while I wrote the post, like I think a lot of the credit should go to Ben. It's a big piece in the bigger puzzle of finding product market fit. And as we've evolved our understanding of who are we actually building for at this point in time, and knowing that it's part of a much bigger vision to continue to build what our mission is, to build the de facto spreadsheet for modern data analysis, we are still building a spreadsheet. But I think, you know, one of the things we talked about when we were kind of riffing on what are the topics that we could cover in this podcast was, are you competing against Excel? Like, is that your biggest competitor? And I'd say, ask me that a year ago, I would have said yes. Now, no. And so I think you look at the landscape of products, and I'll tie this back to pricing. Like, we are building a spreadsheet, and by nature you'd say, well, then you're competing against traditional spreadsheets, Excel, you know, Google Sheets, even Apple Numbers, if you're looking at G2 and that category on G2.
Right? I guess some people use numbers.
Yeah, some people do. Yeah, marketers like me. As we have built a spreadsheet and we are continuing to build a spreadsheet, but as we're trying to find product market fit and monetize, we've realized that that's not the market we're going after right now. We've found a way to, instead of taking a horizontal approach, we've realigned on a verticalized approach to go to market, where we're focusing on solving specific problems for specific people. And right now, or the last 6 months, that has been going really deep on ARR reporting and helping either founders or, you know, the first finance or ops hire at a SaaS business, either B2B or B2C, stand up ARR reporting, which is incredibly important for any business, especially, you know, funded businesses. They need to actually show their investors and show their board, you know, how they're performing. And that ultimately comes down to, I think, for most businesses, revenue. And so we only found that niche because we actually turned off our self-serve funnel. Which is something that, you know, we turned it off completely. We turned that off almost a year ago to this week. And, that was primarily down to needing to get closer to our customers and understand who are we a good fit for? Are we actually solving the right problems for them? Get rid of a lot of the noise, force a conversation, and then make sure that people are set up on the right foot. And that was also during this period, the last 4 months, that was also when we evolved our pricing a lot, like tried a whole bunch of different things to figure out what was right as we're trying to figure out who are we selling to and what for. And, you know, I wrote this post, why we changed pricing 3 times in 1 year, and it kind of summarizes the learnings that we had made. And none of them are rocket science. They're all very obvious things, you know, like people... Yeah. Didn't like usage limits and that harmed adoption. So we got rid of all usage limits. They didn't like to buy things they don't need. And so one of the things we tried to simplify, but also I'd say artificially inflate ARPA, annual revenue per account, average revenue per account, was to sell seats in buckets. And you know, people didn't like that. At least not the people we were selling to, because they're like, I only want one seat, I don't need 5. So don't make me pay for 5 up front. Even though that does work for other companies, and we might even do that later, because now we're talking to people who would rather just buy seats and buckets, right? So to my point on the perfect pricing model doesn't exist, there's trade-offs in either direction. But you know, ultimately where we landed was, one other thing we did try, which is covered in this post I wrote, why we changed pricing 3 times in 1 year, was we actually, for the first time, we're not transparent about pricing. And so—
You went away from transparent.
Yeah, for a hot minute. And part of the reason for that was, as again, we kind of verticalized and we started to selling to a specific type of buyer and a set of tools in another category, call them BI tools, call them like notebooks, and not spreadsheets, we were getting told that we were leaving an incredible amount of money on the table, right? Because that people are used to not paying, you know, $10 a seat. They're used to paying tens of thousands of dollars a year for these other solutions that they could theoretically replace with equals. And so it was like, well, how do we price then? Let's just get rid of price points on the site altogether, because that's anchoring us and not letting us learn what could we charge. And we were getting told by people who were buying that we were so much cheaper than, you know, the $30,000 quote they got from Y competitor when we were, you know, asking for $5,000. And so we did get rid of pricing, not because we didn't have list pricing. We had an idea and we'd tell people who hopped on a call with us what our pricing was. We weren't trying to, you know, charge, you know, Bob $10,000 and this person over here $50,000. That's not what we were doing. We were just trying to figure out, is there an appetite to pay more and do that at scale? And ultimately we learned that that wasn't right for us right now. And we've also like really refined what we're selling and what we're building for. And so I've come full circle. I'd say our pricing right now is incredibly simple. It's purely based on the number of seats that you need and what data sources you're connecting to. Those are the only two things you need to understand. seats, which everyone understands, data sources, I think most of our buyers understand. And then which ones do you need? You pay only for those. And then now we're in a phase of, okay, do we need to think about having concepts of free or cheaper seats? Because, and this was the same at Loom, even it was the same at Intercom, people don't like paying full price for all seats. Like, all seats are not created equal in the world of software. And, you know, there's value in having a viewer only role, but people aren't willing to pay the same price for that as someone who is in the product, editing the spreadsheets, building the dashboards. And so I think that's probably, you know, what we're going to probably maybe figure out next. And then also, how do we charge for data sources where there's a higher willingness to pay, or there's a higher cost associated for us in syncing the data from that data source?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd say everything that is in that post that I learned, again, it's not rocket science. It was more validation. But the biggest learning by far for me was we didn't A/B test anything, primarily for the reason of we don't have the volume to run a test and be able to wait for as long as we needed to see statistical significance. We don't have time. Like, you know, we need to move fast and we need to make decisions quickly. The bigger the changes you make, the faster you will learn. And I think that's not something that I'd done in the past, because when I worked on pricing projects at Intercom, and that last kind of year that I was there, where I was, you know, my task was running the project to fix pricing. You had, you know, tens of, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of ARR at stake. And if you make the wrong decision, it can cost you big time. But we're so early that the wrong decision actually isn't costing us, it's helping us learn faster. So I'd say that was probably the bigger learning for me.
I'm interested in that choice to, or I guess rather, it makes a lot of sense to me when you ship this product that initially appears to be a horizontal product and you're thinking about, like, how do you collect revenue on a horizontal product, which I think is much more complicated, and how do you price a horizontal product? Because a lot of times if it spans a lot of people, they expect a lower cost, that finding this way to follow the customer that your product lends with more, or the kind of is more valuable to, and then decide to pivot to being a vertical product, in this case, selling into data teams. I really like that way of following the user into both your positioning and your pricing. And it makes a ton of sense to me then to back into, like, say, if you decided to go in on marketers, you would not charge the same, you wouldn't charge on data sources, but you decided to go all in on data teams, and actually data sources is a significant thing that they'll pay money for, and that can get you guys to revenue faster.
Correct. Yeah. And I'd say, you know, we right now it's really finance teams that we sell to, if not the founder at very small, you know, Series A companies, where they're just needing to stand up reporting for the first time and report on revenue that is worthy of putting in front of investors in your board. And we've found this, call it niche, where people want the spreadsheet. They because they know it, it's familiar, it's really flexible. You know, there's so much you can do and build in a spreadsheet. And that's what continues to be one of our biggest unique value propositions, is we are a spreadsheet. We are all the things you want these other purpose-built tools to be in a format that you know and that you love, at least for our type of buyer. And so we have that flexibility and familiarity. And then it's been about, like, how do we productize a vertical and build the things they need around this otherwise horizontal platform product to be very good at ARR reporting and be better than what they're currently using. And a lot of that for us has come down to, again, flexibility and then precision, making sure that the data you're looking at is correct. It's how you think about your revenue, not how this company has decided everyone should think about their revenue. And so when we had that sweet spot of, I want a spreadsheet and I'm having problems with accuracy and precision and not being able to trust my data, we're a perfect solution for that. And so that's kind of where we were focused now. And naturally, we sell to RevOps teams who want better insight into their sales funnel and sales pipeline that they don't get out of the box from their CRM, because they're not a dedicated reporting solution. They have a reporting set of features and functionality, but again, they want the flexibility to be able to build their own reports and get far more insight. And so we we are naturally really well suited for that, but we still haven't yet understood what do we really need to build to be, you know, to be great out of the box for many people versus this individual company who needs this specific thing, like LaunchDarkly, who's one of our newer customers in that area.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the next, what's the next vertical? How do we productize that and scale that and then build a go-to-market motion around that? But data sources is interesting there because they're not connecting to Stripe. They're usually connecting to HubSpot or Salesforce, which yeah. they pay a lot more for. And yeah. and so there's already a natural, you know, higher willingness to pay, but we're also needing to, the bigger the customer, we're incurring more of a cost on the syncing side to actually support that data source. So naturally, we need to think about how do we price those data sources differently. And then if we do go into marketing at some point, we'll have that same conversation again. What are the data sources? You know, what's the willingness to pay? I would hate, I think, to end up in a world where we start discriminating on price by seat for different roles. And that just gets really complex and convoluted, I think.
That's super hairy.
Yeah. But then we maybe have modules that, you know, you can buy, which is specific sets of features for different use cases. And then, you know, you run into all the problems that Intercom ran into when everyone hated Intercom for their pricing, which was you feel like you're just getting nickel and dime for every feature. Again, yeah. back to my post, there's no such thing as the perfect pricing model because you just make trade-offs, whether it's for comprehensibility and simplicity. And if you go down the complex route, you know, you're making a trade-off on comprehension for customers and fairness. There's nothing, the perfect pricing model is free, but that doesn't work for businesses, right?
That's super helpful. And I think just recognizing that your pricing model will have to change over and over. That's part of why that perfection is so fleeting, is you're going to have to adapt depending on what your customers look like at this
stage. And if the market changes, right? Intercom's market got so much more competitive in 3 years, really intensely. And that changed how we thought about pricing.
And you gave two examples of products being named. One, you pointed to Apple's Retina display. And in theory, Apple could have just called it their Apple high resolution display, just generic name. And they chose to give it the unique proper name Retina. And then you talked about your other experience. We were at Intercom and your VP of product was building this product that he called an asynchronous messaging product, which you eventually launched under the name Live Chat, like a very straightforward name. Two processes, two very different naming outcomes. So I'd be curious, like, what lenses do you use when you're thinking about naming a product?
Yeah, I'd say, first of all, as a product marketer, I think your job is to know the product intimately and how it works. What's actually been built? How does it actually work? What's the experience for the end user? And then also, if they're not using this thing that you've built, whether it's a feature or a whole product, what are they using instead? What do they call that? How do they describe that? And those are all inputs into how you should think about naming. And then I think from a, like if I was to use a framework, like a very simple framework, first question is, does it need a name? Like, do we actually need to call this anything in our marketing or in our documentation or in our product? And to me, that comes down to, is it either a key part of the buyer's purchasing decision? Like, I absolutely need to check this box that it has this thing in order to buy your product. Is it that? Or is it something that enables you to, is it something that provides unique value that no other product alternative in the market has? If it meets one of those two criteria, then I think it justifies having a name. And then the question is, how do you approach the naming the product? Do you want to create something that is unique in market and that no one else has, and kind of, you know, build a mini, I don't want to say build a category, but, you know, like you would do if you were, you know, establishing a new category for your business. Do you want to do that for this feature and then have to educate the market on what this thing is and why people need it? Apple's not the best, apples to apples, sorry, no pun intended there, comparison, because I think consumer products are so different. Hardware consumer products are so different than B2B SaaS. But if I was to, you know, use the example, I go into depth into this this post I wrote on the topic on naming new product. We were building a new version of our feature that we had called historically AI Assist. And we were leveraging, at this point in time, it was ChatGPT-4's new APIs where you could actually do two-way conversation instead of just ask for something and get output. You could actually then follow up and ask questions. And we were starting to play around with that and think about how could we apply that to Equals. And we ended up building a whole new set of capabilities, introducing the concept of chat with AI inside of Equals, which is not something you could do before. And so then the question begged from my point of view, how big do we want to go and market with this? Like, do we want to, is it really just the next version of what we already have, or is it something entirely new? And how much does naming play a role in marketability there? Should we, if we come out with a brand new name and, you know, maybe personify it, which is always a, you know, is that the right thing to do to personify a piece of AI technology? We question that. But really, if you take a step back, it was like, is this marketable? And if so, would having a unique name, you know, that's less than three syllables, is something that we can own and then build kind of like a sub brand around, is that going to be of value to us or not? And ultimately in that decision, I think it came down to, you know, I even posted the Slack conversation, I think, or the email conversation where we ended up deciding, we're just not going to try and call it something else. Let's just keep it simple. So you can, you know, go in and see warts and all that conversation. But I think ultimately it came down to audience, like who's your audience? If you've done all the other checks of market, like, do I need to call this thing a very specific term so that when buyers are looking at our pricing page, they can check that box? If I don't necessarily have to do that, and I can maybe have a bit more fun with it and create more of a marketable moment by giving it a bespoke name, then it's like, what's my audience? And for us, you know, I think our audience is not too dissimilar to, like, you know, Atlassian for Jira or Linear, where you're selling to a technical audience and a lot of developers, where I think you just need to be a bit more vanilla in your marketing and straightforward and to the point. Like, don't, like, for whatever reason, those audiences don't really gravitate towards the same type of marketing that maybe a sales or a marketing or more of a business type user would. And so I think that's an element in the decision-making process too. Like, let's not try and be cute with it or overthink it. Let's just call it.
Marketers love being cute.
Yeah. And you know, I think having Ben as someone to spar with, who's like, comes at it from a completely different perspective for me, really helps like sanity check. And we kind of get both perspectives. And we ultimately decide, look, let's just call it what it is. Let's not try and be too smart with it. Like, but there are times where I think that it does warrant doing that. And so,
yeah.
But I think probably one of the bigger things I've learned at Equals is my audience is very different to what it was at Loom, which is what different to what it was at Intercom. And so that even in of itself justifies a different approach to thinking about how you name things.
Yeah. I like just even the baseline two filters of newness, like how new is this thing really? Because product people in particular like to think sometimes they're building something new and revolutionary and it's like, maybe not that new. Like even the asynchronous messaging product being called Live Chat. It's like, okay, well this exists. And then secondly, thinking about your audience, like, because I think a lot of times, again, we get so lost in the sauce about like this language makes sense to us. This name makes sense to us. You saw the beautiful slide deck way back here when the product manager was proposing this thing. And then just zooming out and asking the question, like, is this new? And like, how would our customer think about it? Who's our audience? And just letting those lead the way.
And to close the loop on the poll, you know, when Paul called what they built an asynchronous messaging product, he was correct. That's what they built. They hadn't actually built Live Chat. Paul was really big on making it clear that this is asynchronous, because that was one of the inherent problems with Live Chat technology at that point was, people, when they interacted with Live Chat, what was called Live Chat, I think Olac was really the market leader at the time, and then Zopim, which was bought by Zendesk and rebranded to Zendesk Chat, they weren't actually live. It was, from a technology point of view, it was asynchronous. And so we had built asynchronous in terms of a technology standpoint, but my point to Paul was, that's not what people are searching for or what they want to buy. Like, you're thinking about it from the end user experience where they might have a negative experience, but the buyer is still looking for Live Chat.
Yeah.
And if we want to be found, that's where we need to start.